With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Back with me today is independent researcher, writer, and author James Roguski, whose work you can find at jamesroguski.substack.com. Since early 2022, James has been taking the WHO to task with regard to proposed amendments to the international health regulations, as well as the development of what's come to be known as a pandemic treaty. Although, as James and I have discussed in the past, that's not quite the proper nomenclature for it. And perhaps we'll reemphasize that point in our conversation today. But before we get going, James, welcome back. How are you?
Well, you know, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. And, you know, I don't own a television. I don't subscribe to cable or Netflix or Hulu or any of those things. But I've become aware of why people get addicted to, you know, series and programs, because watching the WHO and all of these negotiations is like watching a soap opera. You know, the cast of characters and all of their little, you know, inside information and the plot twists and all of the many secretive dealings and such. It's been quite entertaining, if not enraging.
Yes, it has been. It's a lesson in how extreme bureaucracies can get, to say the least. And with regard to plot twists, we have what was supposed to take place tomorrow, a meeting of the select subcommittee for the coronavirus pandemic. This is a bipartisan subcommittee. It was supposed to take place tomorrow at 10 a.m. And you had proposed questions to be asked by the members of the committee to one of the people who was scheduled to testify. That is Lois Pace, and we can talk about who she is. And you laid out your questions for her in an article at your Substack, Questions for Lois Pace. But there's been some new news, if you will, with regard to this meeting. So what is the current status of this event?
The meeting has been postponed with no date yet to be determined for when they're actually going to have it. And so for a little bit of background, the document that I discovered that opened up this rabbit hole for me was submitted by Lois Pace to the WHO on January 18th, 2022. And it was the original...
And who is she?
She is an assistant secretary with the Office of Global Affairs in the Health and Human Services Department. And she's been a delegate to the WHO and is involved in the negotiations and so forth, and, you know, attends the World Health Assembly. And she was the person who submitted the actual documents and signed off on their submission back in early 2022. And so she was listed as the first person listed as a witness at this meeting, which was to discuss reforming the WHO, which I don't think is really possible, but that was what this discussion meeting, subcommittee meeting was meant to cover. And
can I actually interject with something here? Because Sure. It's the premise of this committee and this meeting is ridiculous, to say the least. And you can find this at oversight.house.gov. under the press release section. This was published last Thursday, the 19th, and it's titled Wenstrup, who's one of the Congress people who sits on this committee, announces hearing on reforming the World Health Organization. And here is a quote from him. in this release, quote, "Instead of prioritizing honesty, transparency, and the health of citizens worldwide, the World Health Organization became subject to overwhelming undue influence from the Chinese Communist Party and placed its political interests ahead of its international duties. Should Americans rely on the WHO when disaster strikes in the future? At this point in time, is it possible for the WHO to be productively reformed? Next week's hearing with expert government witnesses will address these questions and more," unquote. So the premise here is that, or the overwhelming driver of this is that the WHO failed during the so-called pandemic, which you and I have talked about. There was no pandemic, but the driver here is that the WHO failed because it gave undue preference to China, specifically the Chinese Communist Party. So embedded in this, you have this narrative of a rivalry or even a even more of an extreme animus between the US and China. So I just wanted to point that out. I think it's worth pointing out, and that this has been politicized and there's really nothing in here to do with so-called public health.
Oh, absolutely. This meeting, you know, supposedly to reform the WHO, when much thanks to Meryl Nass for pointing out, she was the first person who told me that it was scheduled. So, you know, you find out about it on Thursday. I had actually written that article twice before. I wrote, you know, those types of questions way back in May of 2022. I wrote it again like 6 months ago. And essentially, there are administrative protocols that are supposed to be followed when negotiations are occurring. And there's a lot of details of things that, you know, they failed to do, not the least of which is, you know, any kind of public input. And so what I would like to try to do to summarize just this enormous complexity is there's no reason in the world, really, no good reason, to have the amendments that were adopted last year be allowed to stand. And those amendments, primarily, they do a couple of things because they change five different articles in the international health regulations. These are not the massive amount, you know, 300 plus amendments that many people have been talking about. These are a forgotten change that was made last year, 2022, to shorten the time period during which we'll have to consider this large batch of amendments that are being pushed through now. And so what originally was submitted by Lois Pace, the Biden administration wanted to take the 18-month period of rejection and shorten it down to 6 months. Well, that's a substantial change to review, you know, an enormous amount of changes. But if you do get out your calendar and you look and realize that the meeting in May ends on June 1st, so 6 months from that would be December 1st. That would still be within the Biden's administration, their term in office. And if it had been 18 months, if a new president is elected and inaugurated in 2025, they would have the opportunity to reject the amendment. So that attempt to shorten the timeframe appears that they were trying to be able to run out the clock and slam through some amendments in May, failed to reject them by December 1st, and then it's too late. Well, you missed your opportunity. And so, you know, ultimately the answer is to exit the WHO, but you also have to exit the international health regulations because that is a separate international agreement. Now, Jesse, I don't think I've spoken to you about this before. I've spoken to many people, but I don't think I have with you. Have you heard the story about in July of 1969, three American men put on some spacesuits, got in a rocket, and supposedly went to the moon, came back and splashed down in the Pacific Ocean? I'm curious if you were even
I've heard how old you are. I've heard that story. I don't know how factual it is.
Okay. And so at that same moment in time, in July of 1969, the 22nd yearly World Health Assembly meeting was being held. And that is when they adopted the first international health regulations in 1969. So everybody was either looking up at the moon or watching their fuzzy TV picture. And, you know, who in the world was paying attention to a meeting that was occurred in Boston in July of 1969? So what was in that document is important, but more importantly is what they did not put in that document, which is it did not say, oh, well, you know, after we agree to this here in this little private meeting, take it back to your nation and ratify it in whatever method your nation would properly ratify such an international agreement. No, that didn't happen. The Richard Milhouse Nixon administration signed off on it. That was it. There's no Senate advice and consent that I've been able to find, no mention of it, just signed what is clearly acknowledged to be a sole executive agreement as opposed to a properly ratified treaty. Now, the other thing that they didn't put in that 1969 document was the same exact thing if amendments are put forth at any point in the future, which has happened numerous times. And so amendments don't come back to the Senate for proper advice and consent and then ratification by the president. It's just assumed that you accept them if your head of state, your president, your prime minister, whatever it may be, fails to reject them just by writing a letter to the WHO. Well, here's what happened, and I hope I can draw a visual for everybody. If you can imagine a big round table with 196 states' parties, the 194 members of the WHO, and Liechtenstein and the Vatican are additional adherence to the international health regulations. So there's 196 parties to that agreement. Now, just like you would envision a big coronavirus, draw a line out from the delegates who are seated around that table and draw another circle with the head of state who appointed that delegate. What you have is looks like a monstrous coronavirus with 196 little spike proteins sticking out of it. So you might be able to get a visual, but around that, build a really big wall. And the IHR set up a leadership council where the delegates who are appointed by the heads of state make all these decisions. And it totally cut out we the people. We don't get to vote on it. We don't get to give public comment. And it also cut out Congress and the Senate and Parliament and any other legislative body, when they were landing on the moon, as the story goes, and Richard Milhouse Nixon signed off on this sole executive agreement, that is when we lost our representative democracy in regards to the international health regulations. We didn't technically lose our sovereignty because our leader is at the table along with their delegate and they can reject these changes. But we, the people, don't have any say in it. And it's a problem going all the way back to 1969. It took 54 years for that spoiled fruit to blossom and flower. But that is the cause of the problem. Those agreed upon amendments do not come back to the people for a vote. They do not come back to Parliament or Congress for a vote. They only can be rejected by the head of state. And that is just a dictatorial health totalitarian leadership council that makes decisions.
It was an executive decision.
Right. And so that is where the problem is. And, you know, it's certainly a question, you know, that maybe constitutional scholars will argue about, but it has become crystal clear. This is what I've been trying to raise with people for the last 17 months almost. We're 17 months into an 18-month period of rejection, and nobody in Congress or Parliament has said a word about these agreements, and you know that they're not empowered to do so unless they stand up and call into question Nixon's acceptance of this sole executive agreement. The federal government has no authority over health, so they don't have the authority to hand over authority to the WHO in these regulations. They all, in my mind, are null and void, and we, the people, simply need to stand up and say no.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, for more historical context, what was also happening at the same time in 1969 was the supposed Hong Kong flu was supposedly killing hundreds of thousands of people around the world. I don't know if that motivated this executive decision at all, but it's worth pointing out that that so-called pandemic, quote unquote, was happening at that time. But you also had Woodstock taking place at the same time, where you had thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people with no care in the world about contagion, romping around, doing their thing in very unsanitary conditions. And there was no mass sickness or mass die-off from that. Anyway, the point is to give more historical context in terms of what was going on with regard to so-called global public health events. And perhaps that had something to do, perhaps that informed this executive decision, perhaps not, I don't know, but that was happening at the same time. And that's considered one of the major, in the annals of so-called pandemics, that's considered one of the major world events. Mm-hmm. So just to point that out. Now,
talk about a super spreader event. You know, if anything could have been, you know, Woodstock would have been exactly that, but apparently not so much.
Right. So the subcommittee, as I mentioned earlier, the subcommittee meeting for tomorrow has been postponed, but the questions you laid out for Lois Pace still stand, because this is going to come back around at some point. Or maybe not. Maybe they'll just postpone it ad infinitum. Who knows with how these people work, and given that there's no Speaker of the House. But it's worth going through the questions, I think, and worth at least summarizing what happened back in May of 2022, which you did a little bit, but those details are still important, I think, to home in on. So given that you are the man, or one of the men who's heavily focused on this, where ought we direct our attention next in analyzing what's going on here?
Well, the thing that I just mentioned seems to have been part of the impetus for the submission of amendments to the international health regulations. If you look at the net result of what was ultimately agreed upon, there's no purpose behind it, really. There's no meaningful reason why they want to shorten the time period to consider massive changes. It's not going to save anyone's life. It's not going to bring anyone back.
And well, I agree with you. I will just say, though, that in the video of when those amendments were adopted from May of 2022, which you have embedded in the Questions for Lois Pace article, the reason given by the functionary at that meeting in Geneva who puts forth the amendments before they're adopted, he says very quickly that this is being put forth, this shortened time frame, because there's concern among parties about delays in getting changes implemented through the pipeline, so to speak. There's a very brief mention of that, but nothing detailed in terms of what those concerns are. So essentially the story is we need to move faster with the changes we make. And so that's why we're proposing these changes so that we can, we're proposing these changes, one of which is to change things faster so that we can change things faster in the future with, of course, less oversight.
And that's exactly what it is. So we've gone 17 months almost, it's about a week shy of 17 months since adopting five tiny little amendments, really, to, you know, tweak a few rules and shorten the time period. And there's been zero public discussion, zero, in terms of any parliament or Congress. And so to even begin to imagine that you can shorten that time period and, you know, infinitely almost expand the topics of concern is an absurd, you know, concept. So what actually happened last year, in my view, broke the rules, because the rules are supposed to be, and to her credit, Lois Pace and the Biden administration, they did submit the amendments on time, but they never made them public. To my knowledge, I never found that original document anywhere on any government, U.S. federal government website. Maybe it's hiding somewhere, but boy, it sure is hard to find. It was hidden for 2.5 months. I found it on a blog that somebody had said that they had obtained it, but it wasn't until 2 weeks after that, that in the run-up to the assembly, it wasn't until April 12th that the WHO made these amendments public. The United States and no other nation ever had any public comment on them. There was no, you know, discussion in Congress. And so the questions that I have for Lois Pace and everyone else in the government, quite frankly, is there are rules, there are laws in, you know, the U.S. code. There are rules of, you know, negotiations in the Foreign Affairs Manual where they were supposed to be informing members of at least, say, the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, and public comment is supposed to be given. And the people who are doing the negotiating are supposed to be properly vetted. They're supposed to be properly instructed. They're supposed to have, you know, letters of delegation of authority. You or I couldn't just go into these meetings and be negotiating these documents. It has to go through the Secretary of State and the Office of the Legal Counsel. They have to determine, you know, is this something that is to be treated as a treaty in and of itself because it's changing a, you know, sole executive agreement. There's no paper trail in the Federal Register. And with the video that you're mentioning, literally, if you watch the original version that's on the WHO website, they were having these discussions in public. They shut down the public meeting and they said, hey, you know what, we're going to go in the back room. I mean, they literally said, we've got this room reserved. We're all going to go back there, hash this out. They come back later in the day. They give a brief overview of the agreement that they made in silence. And at that point, there's supposed to be a process, an administrative process by which, you know, all of that is signed off on, Congress being notified, you know, the people having a say in the matter. None of those things happened. What we're looking at the very least, is administrative malfeasance. Okay. They didn't follow their own rules. And you couple that with the meeting that they had. And I think we talked about this back in October, or maybe we didn't. The early October, the working group for the next batch of amendments, the co-chair said to the, you know, entire assembly or the working group that was meeting, you know, we're not going to make the deadline. They're obligated, according to Article 55, to submit the next batch of amendments 4 months in advance. Well, they broke that rule last time. I fully expect them to try to break it again. But they actually said in public that they're just going to ignore the rules and keep meeting up until the last minute, if need be, and avoid, you know, any kind of public comment period. Now, what they also agreed to, which flies in the face of what they've been saying, oh, this is a member nation-led negotiation, right? The WHO is just facilitating it. But then what they agreed is that these 200 pages and all of the negotiations that have been happening over the last year, they want the Bureau, which I interpret as bureaucrats, to rewrite all of that and come up with the draft on December 7th and 8th, which was originally intended to be their final meeting, where they would all agree to this and submit it to the review committee by December 15th. They would look it over and then submit it to the WHO before the end of January. Well, it remains to be seen what that compilation or negotiating text may be. They're busy rewriting it, maybe, or maybe they're just pulling it out of the vault, because this feels like a Delphi technique set of meetings where they make it look like they're listening to all of the nations, but they know exactly where this is headed. And it may very well be that they just drop the document that they've been planning on dropping the whole time. And are we going to get to see it? Are we not going to get to see it? Is it going to be agreed upon? Is it going to continue to drag on until the very last minute? Well, I've taken over the last, really since February, when the review committee came out with their report on the original submissions, I realized that there's a lot of problems. And even Tedros last week said, you know, these negotiations are not looking like they're going to make it on time, that they've got to hurry. And, you know, many other people have said, oh, this doesn't look like it's going very good. They're dropping, you know, documents down at the last minute, similar, but not exactly the same to what we see in Congress. Oh, you'll get to read it after we vote for it. You know, just go ahead and vote and you can read it later once we pass it. That's just not acceptable. And since we know this, our silence would be taken as consent. So that's the last thing I'm going to do, is be silent about what I see as an open plot to break the rules in the same manner that they broke them in 2022. They don't seem to care about their own rules, you know, rules for thee, but not for me, as it seems to be their policy.
Yes. Do you think that because of what happened in 1969, that set some sort of precedent that can somehow be legally justified? Sort of like it's not quite an accurate analogy, but the fruit of the poisonous tree analogy. So it started like this, and this executive decision that the Nixon administration took set the precedent for how things will be decided and rolled out going forward, that this is strictly within the province of the executive branch, perhaps the State Department, but outside of that, we'll bring in Congress, we'll bring in public comment if we deem it necessary. In fact, there's a brief clause in, I think it's the Foreign Affairs Manual, which you cite extensively in this article, that says, and I'm paraphrasing, although I can bring up the exact clause once I scroll down to it, but it says that public comment shall be considered, solicited, and or considered if deemed necessary by the State Department. So certainly it seems that we, the people, are out of the picture, or just barely in the picture. And it seems like, although I can't quite trace this exactly and confirm this, that original executive decision set up the rules, if you will, or the path, if you will, for everything that's happened since then up until this very moment. And it's within the province of the executive branch and the State Department. And perhaps that's it to figure this out. And Congress, citizens of the U.S., if we think that, if we want to throw them a bone and make them feel like they have a say in this, we will. but we don't have to. And it's one of the last things on our mind.
Well, you know, I invite smarter people than me, right, to look at the international health regulations from 1969 and see if they can find where in the Constitution authority was given to the president to make an agreement about health in the United States. Okay, because the Supreme Court has ruled, obviously the Senate can, you know, give their advice and consent about an international agreement, and Congress can be involved if legislation is required to implement whatever kind of agreement there might be. And the president has the authority as the executive to get into an agreement where he has constitutional authority to just sign a sole executive agreement. But I, for one, cannot find where health is one of the 18 enumerated authorities that were given from the states to the federal government. Now, don't take my word for it. 3 months ago or so, Javier Becerra, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, was interviewed in Aspen, Colorado. And the first question he was asked was, you know, what would he like Americans to know about the department that he's the secretary of, the Health and Human Services Department? And he didn't skip a beat. He said, oh, Americans need to understand that the federal government does not have authority over healthcare. That's a state issue.
Which flies in the face of the last 3+ years, but go ahead.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I refer to the WHO as the World Hypnosis Organization. If people behave as if they have authority, but all they really have is the power that comes with throwing around a lot of money that they print, okay? You can mistake power and influence and greed and bribery and extortion for authority. It's very simple. Legitimate authority doesn't flow from the law. Legitimate authority flows originally from the Constitution. There are many laws that are abhorrent to the Constitution and make people believe that these government organizations have authority. But when you look at the Constitution and you do a word search for the word health in the Constitution, let me know if my word search on my computer is missing the word health, because I can't find it in the Constitution. And when the Secretary of Health and Human Services is saying the federal government doesn't have any authority, and one of the appendixes in the international health regulations on page 60 and 61, the reservation that the United States put forth 6 months late, which is kind of interesting how it got into the document, but in the international health regulations from 2005, the mission to Geneva from the United States said very clearly to the WHO, yeah, we accept these amendments, but got to realize we're a federal government. We'll have to ask the states. And so they know that they don't have authority to deal with health on a federal level. But if nobody pays attention and they behave as if they have authority and they exert the power and the influence, because this is exactly what Javier Becerra said. He said, well, you know, we don't have authority, but we sure do have a lot of money. And when they start throwing money at Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare, and whatever else, it influences the states to accept the money and abide by the rules. That's not lawful authority. That's influence peddling. That's blackmail, mm-hmm. extortion, and bribery. Call it whatever you want, money, you know, money laundering, all this sort of thing. It's power, not lawful authority. And this is where people get confused, right? You don't look to the law for authority. You have to look starting at the Constitution. And they are admitting that they don't have authority, but they are really good propagandists and they're really good with money in the sense of they've been doling out billions upon trillions of dollars. It's my contention that if you add up the amount of tax money that has been collected for quote-unquote healthcare since the Johnson administration in the 60s when they started Medicare and Medicaid, And you look at how much money the federal government has paid into the pharmaceutical hospital emergency industrial complex. I think if you subtract the amount spent from the amount of taxes brought in, you're going to end up with our federal debt, national debt of 30 some trillion dollars. We've been vampired. I mean, they've sucked the life out of this country by not collecting enough taxes, but essentially printing or computer generating enough money to fund this mob that is just a band of murderers who create poisons, sell them as treatment for disease, and collect exorbitant amounts of money through insurance schemes and government programs and all that sort of thing. If you do the math, you're going to see the trillions of dollars that we are indebted to China and other nations, you know, and social security system that hold those government treasuries and bonds and such. It's paid for the pharmaceutical hospital emergency industrial complex. That's why we're in debt. It's way bigger than the military industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. Well, briefly on China, I wanted to say something earlier that this is not the sole fault of China, what's happened over the last 3+ years. Just about every nation in the world is to blame because they all acted in lockstep. However, the digitally invented genome of the never been proven to exist SARS-CoV-2 virus did come out of China and was shared with the world. And it's been running amok, never been able to be replicated since then, which is why if you go to GISAID, you see that there are close to 16 million so-called variants now. These are experiments trying to reproduce that genome that, and I put genome in quotes from the Fan Wu paper of early 2020, and they haven't been able to do it. And so you get so-called variant after variant after so-called subvariant ad nauseum. And that stems directly from China. So that needs to be pointed out. But in terms of China bearing sole responsibility for the COVID-19 operation is preposterous. And the US, for example, with its warp speed operation, bears a huge amount of responsibility, especially in terms of maiming and murdering people and poisoning people for life. So I want to make that point. And also to get to your questions for Lois Pace, and perhaps we can go through some of the ones that you feel are most urgent, although I would say these are all urgent questions. But by way of moving into that, I did find the clause from the Foreign Affairs Manual, and it's 725.1, and then in brackets 6, quote, the interest of the public be taken into account, and where in the opinion of the Secretary of State or his or her designee the circumstances permit, the public be given an opportunity to comment, unquote. So the interest of the public ought to be taken into account, whatever that means. That's very vague. And if in the opinion of the Secretary of State or his or her designee the circumstances permit, then the public can, not should, can be given an opportunity to comment. And that's officially from the Foreign Affairs Manual. And that seems to me to have no concern, to be a token gesture toward public comment and public concern.
Well, I will definitely dive in on that. I don't know if you were very much involved or aware, I forget the year, but you know, more than a decade ago, with the very, very secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership that was an agreement that was being pushed through. And, you know, to this day, I haven't put my eyes on that proposal at the time. Senators and congresspeople, you know, were not even allowed to see it, and they had to go into a special skiff to you know, have the chance to look at it. They couldn't photograph it or any such thing. And even just based on, you know, the scantest evidence of what it was that that was trying to do, massive public comment, massive public outcry, massive public, you know, rejection of even the concept that you would give up any national sovereignty and jurisdiction to some kind of organization or board or corporate control to be able to make decisions in regards to what that was all about. That was enough to just shame everybody involved to just drop it. And so what we need is more and more people to just understand what it is they're really trying to do. I put together the peoplesdeclaration.com with all of these many documents. It's hard to read the language in these documents and see what's not there. That's the trick. What's not in these documents is there's not a treaty or any agreement or convention or regulation to put an end to gain of function research. Call it what you want, dual use research of concern. If they were to be doing what they say they're doing, which is to put an end or prevent the next pandemic, the last thing in the world you would be doing is implementing the One Health approach to go searching for pathogens with pandemic potential, bring them back into a lab, do gain-of-function research on them, and try to sequence the genome to make drugs and jabs, which arguably are biological weapons that cause more harm than the pathogen ever would, and then inject that into billions of people. That is biological warfare. They're creating, right, under the guise of preventing the next pandemic, they're setting up the system to create genocide after genocide. And right, maybe, and that's maybe within they the, don't, maybe they themselves the, don't see it, but that's what it certainly looks like.
And that's within the parameters of their narrative of contagion as having been proven, and that gain of function can be done on so-called viruses. And I'm not saying nothing is being done in these biolabs. I think they almost certainly are tinkering with poisons, toxins, and I can only speculate as to what they are and what they're intended to do. But your point stands that if within their, what they are putting forth, their story, this is intended, what they're doing here overall is intended to improve public health on a global scale, which there's a whole conversation to be had about that, as in what gives them the right to do that. But if they are intending to do that, then you're absolutely right to point out within their story where is addressing these huge problems that they are claiming are problems. And even if we understand that their narrative is riddled with assumptions and disproven hypotheses, that there's still a lot of dangerous, poisonous, murderous activity going on, where's the attention being paid to any of this? And it's not there, and one at the very least has to ask why.
And so on stoptheamendments.com several months ago, I think I did it in June, I wrote what looks like a Cliff Notes booklet, okay, and it's a summary of all of the issues to do with the proposed amendments. But the first couple of pages are the things that they're not talking about. And so if you would want to accept that their constitution is valid and that we should be participating with them and should be abiding by, you know, the dictates and things that they do, even if you want to let those assumptions go by, Article 21 of their constitution gives them the authority to adopt, and by them, I mean the World Health Assembly, not the Director General, not the bureaucracy of the WHO, but the 194 member nations and the two that are party to the IHR. They have the authority under the WHO Constitution to write regulations on five separate topics. I'll run through them pretty quick because I know we're getting short on time. They have authority to write regulations for labeling and advertising. Well, boy, it would be really nice if they had regulations that says you can't have a blank insert in these poison jabs, and you can't keep saying they're safe and effective when they're not. They have the authority to write regulations to ensure that they're not contaminated with God knows what. There's a whole list of things that have been found in these jabs. Where's the regulation specifying those standards? They have the authority to write regulations for diagnostic protocols. How in the world is there not a regulation pointing out that using PCR as a diagnostic is about as fraudulent as you can possibly get? They have the authority to write regulations for death certificates and details, you know, whether somebody died with or from COVID-19. And most importantly, they have the authority to define terminology or nomenclature. Well, there is no definition for the word vaccine or pandemic or safe and effective and case, and there's no definition of the word mask. And so for 75 years since the Constitution of the WHO, 76 years since the Constitution was agreed upon, and for 54 years since the first international health regulations was adopted, none of those regulations have found their way into the IHR. So I would not really be okay with it, but it would be one thing if they were addressing the mistakes of the last 4 years and saying, well, you know, masks didn't work. We got to have a regulation about that. Social distancing and lockdowns and quarantines, that obviously didn't work. Travel restrictions didn't work. Tracking and tracing didn't work. What about all of the drugs that you were not allowed to use? Well, that shouldn't be allowed. You shouldn't be allowed to prevent people from trying whatever they want to try. What about midazolam and ventilators killing, what, 80, 90% of the people that that was used on? What about remdesivir causing kidney damage and, you know, uncountable deaths because it's so confusing, it's hard to attribute? Not to mention, you know, where is the data system to collect the adverse event reports on an international basis to hold everyone accountable for injecting people with a biological weapon that is maiming and killing people months and years after, because it's not just a short-term thing. Oh, you know, big spike in death right after you get the jab. This slow burn of increasing deaths because people are getting turbo cancer and myocarditis and everything else under the sun, they could and should be writing regulations and standards to prevent those horrors, but they're not. They're writing regulations to transfer wealth from the developed nations to the developing nations to build out, in their words, state-of-the-art facilities to have more testing and more laboratories and more genomic sequencing and more mRNA manufacturing plants to make more poisons in the nations that they didn't have the infrastructure before. So they only got maybe 25% of the population to accept the jab. They're not even thinking about writing the regulations that they might and should. And they're writing regulations that, even off the top of my head, I think it was on page 74, the International Health Regulations Review Committee in their final report said, hey, wait a minute, you don't have constitutional authority to allocate money within the international health regulations. But that's where the developing nations want that to be done, because they know they can slide through the IHR amendments without any ratification by the nations. They don't want all that equity to just be in the convention agreement, because that's still subject to an approval that would have to be ratified or signed off by. They want the money and the requirement that that transfer of wealth happen in the international health regulations, and even their own expert review committee. I was shocked when they agreed with what I had put out prior. They don't have authority to fund the transfer of wealth into the pharmaceutical hospital emergency industrial complex. And they know it, but they're still trying to do it anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it seems quite clear that the WHO is going full steam ahead and, in fact, adding on to what they've done over the last 3+ years with the COVID-19 operation. And one piece of evidence of that is the SkyCovione COVID-19 vaccine, as it's called, which came out of South Korea and is now being used in the UK. And this is according to precisionvaccinations.com. It's a recombinant protein-based vaccine made of proteins that form tiny particles studded with fragments of the pandemic SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus. These nanoparticles were designed by scientists at the University of Washington School of Medicine and advanced into clinical trials by SK Bioscience and GlaxoSmithKline with financial support from CEPI, Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. In addition, SkyCovione includes GSK's pandemic adjuvant AS03, a substance to help strengthen the immune response to the vaccine. And this is a self-assembling two-component protein nanoparticle that displays 60 copies of the receptor binding domain of the SARS-CoV-2 spike. This is according to them. And more to the point is that on June 19 of this year, SkyCovione received emergency use listing from the World Health Organization and is the 12th COVID-19 vaccine granted EUL by the WHO. The last thing I'll point out is that SkyCovione, which is the SkyCovione is the brand, and SkyCovione is the entity itself, is the world's first ever developed vaccine developed using the Rose TTA Fold, a software tool that uses deep learning to quickly and accurately predict protein structures based on limited information. The Rose TTA Fold was designed as a 3-track neural network developed by the University of Washington. So we're talking about something entirely new here, developed by artificial intelligence that, according to them, contains nanoparticles, self-assembling nanoparticles. And the WHO essentially waved this through, and so did the MHRA in the UK. And it's apparently being used there. So in terms of the WHO having any concern for learning lessons from the last 3+ years, almost 4 years now, it's documents like this make it crystal clear, to me at least, that they don't care about that. And we shouldn't be surprised that they don't care about that. But we should still point this out, nevertheless, as you have been doing for quite some time.
Well, you know, if you're filled with fear from all the propaganda, fear-mongering, and you're gullible, and you're compliant, that'll probably all sound like a good idea. And, you know, it may very well be that this is just a slightly different form of the, way species are called. You know, the weak, maybe the weak in this instance, are those who are compliant and gullible and go along with the crowd, because maybe humans are not supposed to be herd animals. Maybe we're supposed to be capable of independent creative thought, and that we look at each situation and each person determines for themselves what is best for them, rather than feel obligated to do what authority figures or the rest of the crowd is doing. You know, used to be a joke when I was a kid, you know, well, you know, if all of your friends, you know, jumped off a cliff, would you do it too? Okay. You know, think for yourself, make your own decisions. Just because everybody's doing something doesn't mean you should as well. But if being overly compliant and overly gullible and overly trusting of authority is going to be the downfall of 4 or 5 billion people who've been jabbed, that's what we're looking at going into the future.
Yes. Well, James, thank you for continuing to keep tabs on this, and that's putting it lightly. You're doing much more than keeping tabs on it. And I recommend that everybody check out your Substack, read the questions for Lois Pace, because I think that is eventually going to come back around, that meeting. And also check out the latest advanced draft of the so-called pandemic agreement that's been put forth. Perhaps we can have a conversation about that in the near future, James. But thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, too. Have a good day.
You too.